I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On this Christmas Day, some stories behind the news. A little later, we'll meet an American soldier who was photographed cradling an Iraqi child. Find out what it's like to become a symbol of the best intentions of American troops. But first, a look at the war in Iraq through the eyes of an Iraqi journalist. Huda Ahmed worked for Knight Ridder and more recently McClatchy newspapers in Baghdad. Now she's spending 9 months in the U.S. studying at MIT here in Boston as the second recipient of the Elizabeth Neufer Fellowship, sponsored by the International Women's Media Foundation. Elizabeth Neufer was a Boston Globe correspondent killed on assignment in Iraq in 2003. Well, today, Huda joins us in the studio. And we first met you when you first came to Boston in November. So, first of all, how are you doing? How are you settling in?
I'm doing great. Doing fine. I've been settling, and Boston is a very beautiful city.
But it's so, I can't help but thinking, it's so different. I mean, you were plunked out of Iraq.
Yes.
Here. It's got to be
so much different.
Yeah.
It is so much different, the culture, the society. Everything is different from there. So it's like a big leap from there to, you know, to Boston.
Do you find yourself, you know, walking around downtown Boston or traveling, looking around, looking over your shoulder? You're nodding yes.
I'm still doing it. And actually, I still have troubles in sleeping because still having bad dreams. I still hearing the sirens of firefighters and like, oh my God, what happened? Still remember the sirens of the police and the Iraqi army and the American convoys when they make these sirens to move or they want space on the streets. Now I can talk. I talk, you know, loudly. Back there, we cannot talk like loudly if you want to criticize the government or criticize the whatever is happening there.
Well, as you walk around Boston and you see people going about their business, maybe they were shopping for the holidays, do you envy Americans their ease?
I've been envying them because when I see the people like buying gifts for Christmas for their families, and it reminds me of our Eid, you know, after, you know, Ramadan or after the Hajj. When
Eid,
you know,
the Muslim holiday.
Yes, it is the Muslim holiday that so many families, they prepare to buy, you know, new clothes for their children and gifts for them. We miss this kind of life.
Why can't we have this?
Why can't we have this? Why can't, you know, Iraqis go to work safely without thinking that they might be targeted by shooters, they might be, you know, kidnapped, or they might, you know, never come back home, or he might be at work and then he hear that his son or his wife being kidnapped. Why do we have to worry how to buy a rifle to keep it, you know, at home, because the government is not protecting us, so we have to do it ourselves.
You said some, you know, you envy Americans in some ways. I'm wondering if this is an awkward position for you, because you worked for American newspapers in Iraq. You risked your life working with Americans in Iraq. Here you are among Americans in Boston. Do you blame Americans for what happened to your country?
Not the American people, but the American government for their short-seeing. None of the Iraqis have ever dreamt how this going to happen. They've been dreaming of many scenarios to get rid of Saddam Hussein, not to be in war. And not like this. Frustration, devastation among the Iraqi families. We blame them because they didn't listen to the Iraqis. I can't blame the Americans 100% that they are, you know, don't know what's happening back there in Iraq, because it doesn't, you know, doesn't affect their country or influence, you know, their lives. But back there in Iraq and Baghdad, whatever happens here, we get affected with it. The two towers, the Trade Center, this was tragic back there in Baghdad, in Iraq. You know, I called my brother. We were just shocked. We were thinking that's kind of movie or something. Mm-hmm. It's not real happening. And I was calling him, and he said, did you watch this? Oh, my God, all those people are dying, and they are throwing themselves, and it's so bad. What do you feel about it? And he said, I feel so sad because it's like this is not Islam. Those people who are doing this, they are not representing Islam. They are hurting Islam, defaming the beautiful picture of Islam of tolerance and peace and equality and loving. What are they doing?
Your work in Iraq as a journalist is dangerous, not just for you, but for your family. In fact, that's why we're only using your first and middle names, and we're not mentioning your last name, because that could put your family back in Iraq at risk. Why? Why are insurgents and militia members targeting journalists such as yourself?
They started targeting us because they consider us as spies or American agents, and we are feeding the Americans with information when we, you know, talk with them or interview the resistance, they call themselves, or the insurgents or the militia or, you know, officials, ordinary people.
So
it became risky for everybody. It's not only for journalists, even regular people. They get shot from, you know, like he's just, you know, selling, for instance, cigarettes. A gunman will come from his car and ask him for some cigarette. While he's turning to give him some cigarette, he will put a bullet in his head and leave.
But I'm thinking it's particularly risky for a female Iraqi journalist. If Iraqis are starting to distrust the journalists because they think you're spies or something, and if Americans, I'm wondering if the American forces and the coalition forces may not trust you either, not understanding that you're a journalist, you're sort of in the middle.
Yes. It is true.
Yeah, and there was one place in particular. You tell the story of how you went to Najaf to cover when Muqtada al-Sadr's militia had that huge battle with American troops, and they were holed up in a mosque.
Yes.
And you, you know, dodged the bullets to get to the mosque.
Yes, although we have, you know, the press sign on our, you know, flag jacket in Arabic and English, and we were thinking we might get shot from one of the sides, whether from the Americans or from the Mahdi militia, because they were just shooting and randomly on each other. And they have snipers from both sides. But we want to tell the truth because there were, you know, so much confusion about what's happening around the shrine, Imam Ali Shrine in Najaf, and the fights. And when you enter the old city where the shrine is, you know, it was like a ghost city. Only you hear the bullets, RPGs, and the helicopters all above your head, and heavy bombs. When you enter the shrine, there were many of Mahdi, you know, militia and supporters, and we were thinking they're going to be with rifles, but they did not. They weren't. They were like human shields. So we want to, you know, draw the whole picture for the world. What is really happening there?
You know, I'm wondering, you said earlier that, you know, you have dreams now that you're in Boston. Is that one of the things you dream about? What do you dream about?
I dream about, you know, bullets, dreaming of being in a car and bombed, being of all the fights and the wars been there, like coming back to me, dreaming of my family and something bad happened to them, some kind of people from police or from the militia would come and so on, and I'm here, and they like tell them, oh, your daughter is a traitor, she's a spy, and now she's in U.S. and you deserve to die.
Why did you come then?
I wanted to get more knowledge. We've been living in danger for all, you know, almost our life, so this is not something new. But I was thinking that because I live in, you know, very complicated, dangerous, you know, zone there, I couldn't get so much knowledge because I was only involved in my work, but I didn't know what's happening outside that world. So I wanted to do it so I can be able, when I go back, that I will write, you know, stories in depth about my own people to let the whole world to read about it and know what kind of people they live in Iraq.
There are children in Iraq, young, the people who are flocking to the militias have only known violence. I'm thinking if they're 20, 25 years old.
Yes. And I see the children coming up to us carrying flesh of the dead bodies or looking at the site of the dead bodies. And I was like, they are 8, 7-year-old and 13, and why would they be here? They are not afraid on anything. And this is like part of their life, of their daily life. So their innocence being gone. There is no innocence now. And even when they play with each other, they play with plastic rifles instead of playing with soccer ball or playing, you know, the usual kids' games. This is gone for, you know, Iraqi children. And I'm worried about these generations, how they, what they're going to be, what they're going to turn up in the next decade. And most of them now, they became orphans because either they lost both parents in the explosions or in killing or in kidnapping or so, or they, you know, have lost one of them. And they have to live in this misery. They have to work. They have to quit schools and work. Their schools are also threatened by the insurgents. If you go to school, you're going to be killed or your son is going to be kidnapped. So they would keep them at home to teach them at home.
I want to ask you another thing. As an English, an excellent English speaker here in the U.S., you've now been...
Oh, thank you. I'm trying to do my best.
You know, you're doing great. Scanning the internet, you've been looking on YouTube. I mean, Americans are, you know, holding up YouTube and other places as, you know, the new media.
Yes.
But I know you've made some discoveries there that have disturbed you.
Yes. We, the journalists and others, watched videotapes on the internet. Many of them hurt us a lot. There was the recent one I watched. Two American soldiers were on their Humvee, and they were in poor areas, and they were surrounded by young Iraqi children, and they were poor. And the American soldier was shouting and tell them to say, repeat after him, sorry for this word, F Iraq. And the kids were repeating after him, F Iraq, and he was laughing with his colleague, and I felt so sad. Is that what you bring in for us and for our children?
Did you have good experiences with coalition soldiers, U.S. soldiers?
I can't blame them all. I mean, some of them are good soldiers, and they really love the Iraqis, and they want to help. I've been hearing from citizens, like, for instance, there is the city in the north. It's called Mosul. And there was a particular unit that when I talked with those people from Mosul, and they said, we are so sorry that and sad that this unit is leaving because they were so good with us. They knew how to deal with us. And we felt that they love us. They care for us. They're not like killing us from one hand and give us sweets from the other hand. Those, you know, soldiers, they were doing their best to help us. And we saw that in their eyes.
Well, in fact, later in the program, we're going to hear from one American soldier. He gained international attention for the compassion he showed one Iraqi child. That story is coming up. But when we come back after a break, we'll continue speaking with Huda Ahmed, an Iraqi journalist who's just come to Boston to study under a fellowship, but risked her life to report for the American McClatchy newspapers in Iraq. We'll have more with Huda Ahmed when we come back. Stay right there. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been speaking today with Huda Ahmed, an Iraqi journalist who worked for Western newspapers in Baghdad and is now studying here in Boston at MIT. Huda, I want to talk about the news from Iraq. The sectarian divide between Sunnis and Shiites is deepening. Some news organizations are saying that Iraq is in a civil war. You say that the politicians are the ones exploiting the differences between people there for their own purposes, and that drawing attention to the different sects is part of the problem. You've been puzzled, in fact, that people here in Boston ask you whether you are Sunni or Shiite. What do you say when people ask you that?
I'm Iraqi Muslim and proud to be that. All our life we felt we are united. My friends, my relatives, my neighbors, we never like ask each other, these are Shia or these are Sunnis. Don't go there for their parties. No, go to that side and so on. Now, if we go to anywhere, whether in colleges, universities, schools, in markets, and ask the people, are you Sunni or Shia? Because I want to ask you this question. Say, no, don't ask me that question. Give me your question. I'm Iraqi Muslim, but don't ask me if I'm Sunni or Shia.
We know that the Shia were the majority that were oppressed by the Sunni minority in Iraq during Saddam Hussein's regime.
They were not oppressed by Sunnis. They were oppressed by Saddam and his regime, but not by, you know, the Sunnis. Otherwise, if they were oppressed by the Sunnis, they wouldn't have intermarried. They wouldn't be relatives. They wouldn't be having cousins and uncles, Sunnis and Shia, mixed. Saddam Hussein and his regime, they tried to make these differences between us. Yes, I agree. There are, you know, some differences. But these are differences in how you, you know, do your rituals. That's all. But not difference that make us, like, hate each other or kill each other. And Saddam was trying to do that. And he tried to favor the Sunnis and the Christians and so on. But to tell me that they oppressed us, no. And we never blamed them that they were favorites.
I know you still stay in daily contact with some of your Iraqi journalist colleagues back in Baghdad.
Yes.
What do you talk about, and why is that important for you to stay in contact?
So I can still feel that I'm close to my friends and colleagues and my family and to the situation there, still inside and outside in Iraqi, you know, and also to still contacted with the news there and the changes, because everything change every day. You know, I cannot give you a straight answer whether, like, for instance, if you ask me, what do you think whether our American soldiers, troops, you know, withdraw from Iraq or not? Is it a good moment or not? I can't give you a straight answer. I can't give you an honest one because every day things change. Like, I can tell you today, well, I am with the withdrawal of American soldiers, but, you know, gradual withdrawal. And the second day I will come to you as no, because it depends on the situations there that change so fast.
You know, we started, Huda Ahmed, by asking you how it felt to be suddenly, because you've just arrived in Boston, everybody, you know, having their Christmas or Hanukkah or some sort of holiday. It's just a very festive, family-oriented time in America, and here you are. And, you know, when you were here recently, I happened to be standing in the hall when you came out and you greeted one of our colleagues. She was from your region, and it was such an emotional moment for you.
It is very hard, and especially there is the Eid, the EID.
Yeah.
This is the big Eid, we call it, the big festival. And I feel so sad that I'm not among them this year. It is sad that you cannot feel the happiness of the Eid because of what's happening. And the families there, they don't feel that now anymore. But it's just that you would like to be among them, whether the situation is bad or not. Just, you know, even if you don't feel the Eid, it's just a routine Eid going to be, you know, greet each other, kiss each other, wish each other good Eid and good year and what their future will be and so on. That's what I miss. So I'm planning, like, to call them 3-4 times a day, every day nearing to the Eid, so they can feel that I'm with them. And actually, they are more worried about me than I am. Like, oh, you are alone. Are you eating well? Do they feed you well? And how you feel you're alone there? When you get sick, nobody's around you. My mother, like, keeps for half an hour just to say, how are you and how are you doing? How's your health? Are you eating well? Be careful. You have to eat halal. You have to have meat on the, you know, Islamic way to slaughter the lamb and so on the Islamic way. So, like, you have to be careful, you know. You don't drink alcohol. Like, no, I don't drink alcohol, mother. You know that.
Well, Huda Ahmed, again, an Iraqi who worked as a journalist for Knight Ridder and McClatchy newspapers while in Iraq, and is now going to spend 9 months in the U.S. studying at MIT, the second recipient of the Elizabeth Neufer Fellowship. It's sponsored by the International Women's Media Foundation. Elizabeth Neufer, the Boston Globe correspondent who was killed on assignment in Iraq in 2003. You know, we knew her here at Here and Now. She would be very proud of you.
And I'll be very grateful because she was really a great female journalist. Though I know her for a short time.
You knew her in Iraq?
Yeah, yes. I was there in the office when we heard the news of her death. And she was full of life. She was full of activity. She was always smiling and laughing and making jokes all the time. And I always, you know, remember her with her smile face. I'm so grateful that she would know that I'm here and would love her that she hears me, that I really love her and admire her, how courageous she was and how aggressive in her questions. And I was looking at her when she was asking the questions is my example, but never thought I'm going to be recipient of her fellowship.
And here doing that, following.
Hope so.
Yeah. Huda, I know it's hard, but happy holiday to you.
Thank you. You too.
And thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Robin, and wish you a happy, happy holiday to you and all the American listeners and to all the Iraqis and the Arabs and the whole world.
Stay with us. Our special Christmas edition of Here and Now will be right back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We hope you're having a happy holiday, and we are spending it today with people behind the news headlines. Photos of the war in Iraq provide us with some of the most gripping accounts: blown-up buildings, car bombs, bullet-pocked walls. But one picture flying around the internet shows a different side of war. It's a snapshot of an American airman cradling an injured Iraqi toddler, a little girl, on his chest as they both nap in a chair. It was taken at Balad Air Base north of Baghdad. 49-year-old Chief Master Sergeant John Gebhardt was stationed at the hospital at the time of the picture. He's now superintendent of the 22nd Wing Medical Group at the McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, Kansas, where, Chief, I am imagining you are adjusting to the fact that people around the world are seeing your picture.
Yes. At first, it was rather difficult because that photo is what I've seen daily over there, what people were doing, and seemed a little different that it happened to be me that was getting all the attention when there's so many people doing great things.
Well, tell us about that photo. What happened to that little girl? How she, you can see that she has a long scar on the back of her head, you know, her face buried in your chest. But what happened to her? How'd she get there?
My understanding is her family was executed. The young child's face was completely fine. Mm-hmm. And then the back of the head basically blown off.
Well, and we understand reports say that it was an insurgent attack on her family.
Yes.
You were not her doctor, right?
No, I'm not. I'm actually like a group superintendent. I actually don't do medical care. Mm-hmm. I kind of oversee the enlisted portion as far as the mission and taking care of the people. And you kind of pitch in everywhere you can. And one of the things I could help to do to help the great nurses and technicians is help comfort the small child, talk to the troops. You know, it was something I certainly enjoyed doing. Certainly, as everyone has a deep pain in their heart when they see an injured child, I enjoyed it, and hopefully it helped comfort her also.
Well, the nurses there said that you actually had a knack for comforting her, and it became sort of a regular thing. What are you thinking when you're holding that little wounded child?
Of how blessed I've been in my life and my family. My kids are quite a bit older. You know, you just pray for peace and pray for a better life for her and all the other Iraqi children, and even our families back home. And how fortunate we don't live in a society where you're sought out basically based on your beliefs, and just hoping the best for the future for all the people in that region.
Do you know what happened to the little girl?
My understanding is, you know, that photo was taken just a couple days before I redeployed back to the States. About 2 weeks after that, a relative and uncle came and picked her up and took her home.
You know, it strikes me that we just did another story about another soldier who actually rescued a little girl and brought her here to Massachusetts for surgery. He unfortunately died. Chris Walsh was his name, and he was also from Kansas. Did you see that?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yes, I did. I think it helps family members back here, you know, who, geez, you know, and I feel terrible that I'm a hero or called a hero, and so many people do the same things. And that's a daily thing. You know, that wasn't the first child I got to hold or go talk to an American soldier who was wounded. If I could get away with it, I'd hug them all. I'm not a big hugger as a normal thing, but, geez, you wish you could do something for them, you know, for the injuries they go through and the courage they show. You know, a lot of times it's hard to understand why we go and what we do, and it helped my wife understand what we do, and
But that is an interesting point, that this photo and the story of Chris Walsh, how much it helps the family back home to know that those things are happening.
Yes, you know, and realize that it's not the stereotype of the blood and guts, hardcore killers that people think. That, you know, nobody hates war or dislikes it more than people who serve in the military. It's not something you look forward to or something you want to do, but, you know, as part of serving a higher cause, you know, we go to help people. And unfortunately, there is death and injury that goes with it, but our true hearts of hearts, it's to lift people up so they can have a more level playing field to have their children grow. And we have in that facility over there, 2 days a week, there's visitation days where Iraqis come on base, some of the parents of the children. And it's amazing, you know, the first day you see them when they come in for visitation, you know, it's their first face-to-face interaction with an American. By the time they leave, they smile at you, you know, they wave, you know, they put their hand on their chest, which means hello, bless you. And how quickly the walls come down when it comes to family and love and care and compassion for the brothers and sisters. And it is happening every day. The things that Americans want to believe about themselves, it is happening. It doesn't make news, and I'm not trying to slam the media or say anything bad, but that doesn't sell.
Well, but you couldn't be saying that we not report on the failures and the problems.
No, absolutely no. Those have to be told. That's the reason we live in a society we do, and I think it's so great. And honestly, I can speak freely. You know, there's nobody in here monitoring me, listening to what I say. I can say whatever I want. I saw people, just great Americans, you know, giving their best and trying to help in any and every way they could. It's just the nature of Americans in general. You know, we're very caring, compassionate people. And that brings out the best in everybody, and it's made me a better person. And I'm just humbled for the last almost 28 years that working with professionals who believe in a higher calling and sacrifice a lot with their families, being away from their families. You know, so many of the people I work with, their wives are pregnant, and they're having babies born at home and while they're away, and they want to reach out and help others.
What do you think about the debate in the U.S. right now about whether or not troops should withdraw or there be more troops sent to try to quell the insurgency and the sectarian fighting?
I don't know. Above my pay grade. And I really don't know. I wish I had the answer. If I had the answer, I'd be the first one to send it off to President Bush. I thought about it a lot, and I don't have the answer. Like most people, I pray every day for all the people over there. I pray for our leadership, for their strength and wisdom, that they make the best decision. You know, me personally, I believe we're over there for my grandkids that haven't been born and their children, and it's a long-term decision, which is a tough thing. And I pray we do the right thing for the American people, for the Iraqi people. It takes time for history to write itself, and I believe we're doing the right things for the right reasons for the future of America.
Chief Master Sergeant John Gebhardt, Superintendent of the 22nd Wing Medical Group at the McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And this quick news note, another spot in the Middle East that draws attention on this day is the little West Bank town of Bethlehem. The mayor of Bethlehem, a Palestinian Catholic, is calling on Christians around the world this year to visit the traditional birthplace of Jesus. The town once attracted 90,000 visitors a month, but tourism plummeted after the Palestinian uprising began in 2000, with only 2,500 foreigners visiting last Christmas. The town also faces economic problems. On the one hand, the Israeli government has built a wall to prevent attacks, but it also cuts people off from jobs and relatives in neighboring Jerusalem. On the other hand, Hamas, which is the governing body in the West Bank and therefore Bethlehem, has not come up with promised funding for the town. But the mayor of Bethlehem remains hopeful, saying, "We pray that the star of the Nativity will shine on Bethlehem once again and guide all people of goodwill toward our little town to restore its former glory as an open city for peace." Listening to Here and Now. A new poll shows that America's favorite holiday tune is the Christmas song. You know, chestnuts roasting on an open fire, all that. But making a surprise leap up the Yuletide charts, the Pretenders' version of an old gem.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
Chrissy Hynde of the Pretenders singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. She says it makes her cry to sing it. She thinks of all the people that she isn't seeing. It was originally written in 1943 for the musical Meet Me in St. Louis, and it was sung by the legendary Judy Garland.
Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore.
Well, there's quite a story behind Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. It was written by Hugh Martin and Ralph Blaine, and the original tune was anything but merry. Hugh Martin is now 92 years old, still writing music. Hugh, welcome.
Hello, Robin.
Well, you've gotten quite a bit of attention lately because Entertainment Weekly actually published in the magazine some of the original lyrics. Well, they were kind of depressing. You know them.
Ridiculous. I'm ashamed of them. But at the time, I thought they were just dandy. And Judy Garland said, I can't sing that to little Margaret O'Brien. The audience will think I'm a monster.
Well, let's remind everyone, Judy Garland plays Margaret O'Brien's older sister in the film. They're about to lose their home, and she sings her this song in this pivotal moment. And the original lyrics that you'd written were, Have yourself a merry little Christmas. It may be your last.
That's terrible, isn't it? I don't know what I was thinking of.
Oh, it goes on. Next year, we may all be living in the past.
Isn't that dreadful?
Faithful friends who were dear to us will be near to us
no more. Oh, I'm so embarrassed. I'll never outlive it.
Well, but at the time, you thought it was appropriate, right? It became a big tussle on the set.
It was a sad scene, and I thought they wanted a sad song. I guess I was just young and arrogant and thought that I had done a good job. And so I said, well, you can have it if you'll take the lyric. And, of course, she said, well, then I can't take it. The whole thing would have evaporated except for Tom Drake. He played the boy next door.
Oh, right.
And the one that Judy was in love with in the movie.
Right.
And Tom took me aside and said, you're the most stupid, stubborn son of a gun I ever met. This is a great song, and you're absolutely insane not to do what Judy wants you to do. Well, somehow he got through to me, and I went home and wrote one. And the next day, I brought it to the studio, and everybody said, wee, whoopee, this is it.
It switched to Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Let Your Heart Be Light.
Exactly. It's the way I should have written in the first place.
The other lyric that was so difficult for everyone was the ending, where you had written originally.
Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. I still like that line. It kind of mingles the sad with the happy.
Dozens have performed the song, although we should mention you have said that the real badge of honor came when the metal band Twisted Sister.
I've never heard that one.
Well, let's listen to that.
Let's listen to that. Well, I'm dying to hear it. I'm absolutely appalled. I can't believe my ears. But, you know, it's exciting to hear all the different versions. I feel so thrilled that God blessed me in this way. And it connects me with the younger generation. When I hear all these lovely, young, sweet, clear voices singing my song, it really makes me cry. Mm. The tears just come right out of my eyes. I'm so touched that people love it. And I feel so blessed that I've been able to hit on something that just strikes a nerve with people.
Well, on behalf of all of us, I'm so thrilled to be able to say thank you. And have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Indeed
you.
I will. Okay. Thank you so much.
Hugh Martin, one of the original writers of the holiday favorite, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away.
Stay with us. Some gospel music for the holidays. That's still coming up. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Silent night. Oh. All is calm, all is bright round yon virgin mother and child.
That's the country group Alabama off their latest CD, Songs of Inspiration. And with apologies for bringing in a dollop of commercialism on a Christmas day, it sure is selling. The band's first foray into religious inspirational music is doing well, and they're not alone. As Sarah Rodman of the Boston Globe wrote recently, a number of artists from different musical genres are making gospel albums. As she writes, and again with our apologies, in the music industry, it is a good time to be in the God business. And Sarah Rodman joins us in the studio with more. Welcome and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
You know, it's good for the business and good for us, because we're going to hear some of that beautiful music in just a moment. But how have the sales of gospel music increased? How are you seeing that?
Well, it's interesting. The Gospel Music Association puts out a report every year, mid-year and at end of the year. And they reported in July that sales were up 11.6%. Gospel is only one of two kinds of music that is experiencing growth in the industry, the other kind being country music, and those two things dovetailing because of the records that are coming out. With the Alan Jackson and the Alabama, it counts towards both tallies.
Right. Well, let's listen to some of the Alan Jackson from his CD, Precious Memories. It's a collection of gospel classics. Here's his I'll Fly Away.
Some glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away to a home on God's celestial shore. I'll fly away. I'll fly away, oh glory, I'll fly away. When I die, hallelujah, by and by, I'll fly away.
Sarah Rodman, you get the feeling that Alan Jackson sung that song before.
Yes, yeah. Alan Jackson, I'm sure, has sung that song many times, as many of us have. It's a really popular one to do. And he has said that he recorded this album specifically for his mother. It was something that he wanted to give her as a gift, and that he's been really surprised at how well it's done. It sold over a million copies.
This revival, though, of gospel, you know, in a real concerted effort to record it on CDs, really started post 9/11?
It's always been a popular music, but there was a real uptick in sales post 9/11. And Patti LaBelle actually was one of the people I interviewed for my story, and she was saying, and I think a lot of people agree, that people, you know, were seeking spirituality again. And a lot of people went back to church after, and regardless of what their church was, their temple, their mosque, they went to find their God again. And a lot of people embraced Christian music along the way as part of that.
Patti LaBelle is one of the artists that has made a gospel recording, included gospel segments in her concerts for quite some time. So for some of these artists, it's not as much crossing over as crossing back.
Exactly. Many of these people are both Southern and have church roots, and they started singing in the choir as kids, and it was something that they've always done. I mean, Randy Owen talked a lot about sort of sitting around the piano with his whole family when he was growing up on Sundays after church and singing these songs, and their careers just didn't go that route, and this is something that 201 they've said they've wanted to do for years.
You mentioned Randy Owen from Alabama, but here's Patti LaBelle. Her CD is called The Gospel According to Patti LaBelle, and this song is called Anything. Sarah, we understand Patti LaBelle donating some of the proceeds from this record to cancer charities.
She's actually donating all of the proceeds from this album to cancer charities. She lost all three of her sisters, her musical director, whose idea it was to do this gospel album, and several friends to cancer in the past decade. And so she said to me, honey, I'm not getting rich off this. I'm giving this money, you know, to a charitable cause.
I've always wondered about gospel artists who didn't cross the other way, who didn't go from gospel to rock. And they're so extraordinary. Before we started here, you and I were talking about Yolanda Adams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm wondering, how do they feel about the big names of rock now coming onto the gospel charts.
The people that I talked to, the head of the Gospel Music Association, John Still, was of the belief that a rising tide lifts all boats, that this is only good news for the gospel community. When people who have recognizable names come into the gospel community, people might go to Alan Jackson and say, "Ooh, well, maybe I'd like this gospel artist." Or they listen to Patti LaBelle and say, "Well, maybe I'd like Mary Mary."
They may go to Alan Jackson and find Mahalia.
Exactly.
Well, blues guitarist Johnny Lang also made a gospel-tinged album, Turnaround. Remind us about him, and we're going to listen to his Thankful.
He came out, I want to say about 6 or 7 years ago, as this real blues guitar whiz. He was a teenage prodigy in this sort of Stevie Ray Vaughan, Eric Clapton mold. And he had a couple minor radio hits and a really good player, very well respected. And these last two records that he's made a turn towards gospel music. But the sound is still blues rock, but his lyrics have taken on a deeper spiritual meaning.
Just so much longer. Yeah, you bless me, Lord. Now every day I'm gonna take the time and stop to be thankful.
Little Johnny Lang from his Turnaround CD, a song called Thankful. Well, Sarah, we asked you about, the gospel singers who haven't crossed over to rock so that they could then cross back to gospel. And we're thinking of the Boston-based singer Frida Battle.
Frida has been making gospel music for about 20 years. She's based right here in Boston. She leads a local ministry, and she's been making records that have gained a national profile for a long time. She's an extraordinary singer, and even somewhat more importantly, she's brought along a lot of new songwriting into the gospel genre, where a lot of people record the same songs over and over again. She was one person who said, there might be some skepticism in the gospel community about the popular artists crossing over, but that she feels that these people have God in their hearts, and it's what they're meant to do. And anybody spreading the good news is good news for the gospel community.
Here is Frida Battle's For All You've Done For Me from her album Here Is Our Praise.
I could not
praise you for what you've done.
And it would take eternity.
I can see the choir, Sarah.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it is. We're both moving here. Sarah Rodman, talking about the resurgence and popularity of gospel music. Great year for gospel music in 2006. Do you see it continuing in 2007?
Yep. They are ending the year still on an up note. And I think that, what's interesting about it is that a lot of the people that are really enjoying gospel music now aren't big downloaders. There's still people that are going into the store buying records. So I would imagine, yes, as there's more kinds of gospel music, country, rock, hip-hop, hard rock, that, people who are seeking out this kind of music will find the kind of music that they like to have this message in it.
And who knew that gospel might be the genre that keeps, record stores open and
exactly. Keeps
the industry breathing. Sarah, we'll see a list of all the CDs you recommend on our website, here-now.org. Meantime, thank you so much. What a great sound you bring us today. Thanks, and have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
Sarah Rodman of the Boston Globe. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a Merry Christmas if you're celebrating, a lovely day if you're not, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio.